Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started. I'm going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary together. I see the judge is holding court and hopefully getting everyone in line so no one will be in contempt. We have three bills that we're going to be taking public testimony on today. We will not be able to work those because none of the bills have the necessary paperwork to work them, even if we wanted to at this point. We do have one work session bill, which is Senate Bill 46, and since I have members that are going to be coming and going today, I'd like to go ahead and do the work session first. So let me open up work session on Senate Bill 46.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 46, we heard on March 11th, and this was the shortening the time period to bring a lawsuit against a design professional from 10 years to 6 years. There is a dash 2 amendment, and that amendment shortens the statute of ultimate repose from 10 years to 6 years for design professionals for large commercial structures as defined as ORS 701.005. That's consistent with what we did several years ago with the general contractors. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on the bill.
All right, thank you. So with that, Chair moves the adoption of the dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 46. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, could you just on page 2 of the amendment just have the staff explain to us the main difference between subsection B and C there, the 10 years and the 6 years, one a small commercial structure and one a large?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Close, as I put in my SMS the definitions between small commercial structure and large commercial structure. So what we're talking about in the bill is taking the large commercial structure, reducing that time period, but with small commercial structure, which means a non-residential structure, if you see in the SMS, and all those definitions there, that would still be 10 years. Does that make sense?
I guess what I'm asking is the difference in square feet. I could do the math here, but I wonder if you could tell me quickly.
I'm not good at doing the math quickly.
Sorry. That's why we went to law school.
I've got my calculator here if you guys would like
so,
to.
So what this does, is that the same delineation in the bill we passed before?
It is.
Yes.
What we're trying to do is keep everyone in the same type of structures consistent
with
as to what the statute of limitations will
be. And this will be the same. This matches that up.
Yes.
That's the plan.
I like that.
Okay, we have architects here, probably better with the numbers.
Yeah, if we need someone to bring out a slide rule, we could do that problem. Oh, I mean a calculator.
She is ready. She can answer if you want it.
She's
saying, you'd like to come up and get on the record or not?
I could answer a question if Senator Close wants to answer.
Do we have time?
Yeah, sure we do.
Thank you.
Please come forward, Cindy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent the American Institute of Architects, who is one of the sponsors of this bill. As was pointed out before, it is bringing it in line with construction contract laws and their definitions of commercial versus and small. Large project and small project is actually based more on occupancy than size. So if it's a residential, if it's a smaller retail building, if it's in a condo association, so that's large, but it's a condo association, those are all 10 years. It's only your large commercial structure then that becomes 6 years.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Any other discussion or comments? Any objection to the motion of moving the dash 2s into the bill? So ordered, and the chair will take a motion on the amended bill.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 46 as amended by the dash 2s to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Close moves Senate Bill 46 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended with the dash 2s. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And let's see. Chair will carry 46 to the floor. We'll close the work session on 46. And did we have a particular order you wanted to go in on?
Yes, let's do 798.
All right, so we're going to go ahead and open up our first of the three public hearings on Senate Bill 798. Anna?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 798 allows a court to replace juror with an alternate juror in a criminal case after jury begins deliberations in certain circumstances. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, and we have a few people who want to testify. It looks like Judge Shinache, Charlie, why don't you come up, and Gail Meyer, And it looked like we had Mary Stewart, but it's been crossed out, so I'm assuming she does not want to testify. Besides the two that are coming up, will there be anyone else who would like to give testimony today on Senate Bill 798? Okay. Your Honor, if you'd put your name on the record and give us your testimony, that'd be great.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Charles Zanashe. Thank you for allowing me to testify today, excuse me, on Senate Bill 792-2, and I want to thank Senator Przanski for sponsoring this bill at my request. I am a circuit court judge in Lane County, and I want to make clear that the views I am expressing here are my own, and I do not speak on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department. Senate Bill 798-2 addresses two different but related issues. First, the bill addresses the manner in which alternate jurors are selected in criminal cases. Second, it gives the trial judge the authority to substitute an alternate juror for a juror who dies, becomes ill, or is otherwise unable to complete deliberations. Both of these changes mirror changes that have been approved by the Council on Court Procedure to Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure 57, which governs the selection of alternate jurors in civil cases. In criminal cases, the accused has a right to a trial by jury, either a 6-person jury for misdemeanors or a 12-person jury for felonies. Each of the parties is entitled to a certain number of peremptory challenges, which is the right to remove a potential juror for any reason they deem fit. If the trial is to a 6-person jury, each party gets 3 peremptory challenges, and if it is to a 12-person jury, each party gets 6 peremptory challenges. The court may also appoint alternate jurors who sit through the case to hear the evidence just like the other jurors. These alternate jurors are there if one of the other jurors becomes ill or is otherwise unable to complete deliberations. Currently, Oregon law provides that alternate jurors are to be selected after the jury is impaneled and sworn. Likewise, the law gives each side an additional number of peremptory challenges for use only against alternate jurors, one if there are up to 2 alternate jurors being selected, and 2 peremptory challenges if there are up to 4 alternate jurors being selected, and 3 if you're selecting up to 6 alternate jurors. However, many judges throughout the state are, by agreement of the parties, utilizing methods of selecting jurors that depart from the statutory procedure. For instance, it is common for judges not to swear the jury prior to the selection of alternate jurors. Similarly, many judges and lawyers fear that alternate jurors may not pay close attention to the evidence and the arguments if they know they are alternates and therefore believe they are not likely to participate in deliberations. To avoid this issue, many judges choose to conduct jury selection in a manner that does not identify who the alternate jurors are until the completion of the case. The changes to ORS 136-260 found in Section 3 of the bill are designed to give trial judges discretion over how jurors are selected. This eliminates any argument that the procedures are somehow invalid despite the agreement of the parties because they are not in compliance with current statutes. The second change Senate Bill 798-2 makes to existing law is to allow judges to replace a juror who dies, becomes ill, or is otherwise unable to complete deliberations with one of the alternate jurors who sat through the trial. Under the current law, the trial judge is required to discharge alternate jurors when a jury begins deliberations. The only exception to this requirement now is in situations where the defendant is to be tried on enhancement facts. Those are facts that, if found by the jury, will give the trial court the discretion to impose a greater sentence than that which would otherwise be imposed under the sentencing guidelines. Thus, under current law, if a juror becomes ill or is unable to complete deliberations just moments after deliberations have started, the trial judge has no discretion to replace the juror with one of the alternates. Instead, a judge must either get the parties to agree to proceed with fewer jurors or declare a mistrial. This means that in situations where the trial has lasted many weeks, taxpayers may have to bear the cost of retrying the case, even though there are alternate jurors available who have sat through the entire case, who have heard all of the evidence, and who have listened to all of the arguments in counsel. Section 1 of Senate Bill 798 gives the trial judge the discretion to replace a juror who cannot complete deliberations with an alternate juror, provided that neither party can establish that it is prejudiced as a result of that replacement. If the judge chooses to replace the juror, the trial judge is to instruct the jury to begin deliberations anew. I want to make clear that the bill does not require the judge to replace the juror with an alternate, thus gives the trial judge, continues to have the discretion to declare a mistrial if the judge feels substituting an alternate juror is inappropriate for any reason. Of course, as an alternative to replacing the juror, the parties might stipulate to proceeding with just the remaining jurors as well. Thank you for your time and consideration of this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right. First, we'll take Gail Maher's testimony, then we'll open up for questions. Gail?
Thank you, Chair Prozonski, members of the committee. Gail Maher on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm really up here to say we're still looking at this. And I didn't realize there was a Dash 2 amendment, and we'd like to have an opportunity to look at it. We're mindful that in the federal system, the federal courts, the advisory committee to the rules of federal criminal procedure opted for a different way of proceeding. Once deliberations begin, the federal rules say it's better to either declare a mistrial or go with 11 jurors than to introduce a new juror into the mix. We're not sure whether we like that. We're still looking at it. One thing that's a unique wrinkle in Oregon law is Oregon's the only state in the nation that allows for a 10-2 jury verdict. So when you if you were to have deliberations and a finding of guilt on a 10-2 verdict, and then the jury were to begin deliberation on the enhancement facts, and one of the jurors became disabled, unable to perform as a juror during the enhancement fact trial, and were to go, current law states that if you need to have the 10 jurors who found guilt be the same 10 that find the enhancement facts. And so we're a little concerned right now about how that would look in the enhancement fact phase. And so I apologize to the chair and the committee. We're not quite sure what we think yet.
Okay. Questions first, Senator Cruz, please.
Yeah, just interesting. So at this point, one of the points you made there, so people are paying attention. So, for example, you have a 12-person jury with two alternates, and they would those 14 would hear the entire case before the judge makes a determination. Okay, that actually makes sense.
That one clarification, Judge Zinasche, I'm assuming that at that point you would know as the sitting judge which 12 had actually been selected. The panel itself would not know who the two alternates. In other words, you wouldn't get to choose of the 14, the 12 you want to go in to get?
Actually, different judges around the state have done this in different ways. Everyone but the jurors know who the alternates are in the beginning because there's an agreement on the procedure. Some judges actually have taken to selecting, for instance, 14 people and then randomly drawing names out of a hat to identify who the two alternates are at the end. Basically, what this does is leaves it to the sound discretion of the trial judge as to how that's going to be done.
Okay. Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you.
I'm fine. I just found that to be an interesting concept.
Well, yeah, before your question, I mean, I would not want to have an individual, the judge or whoever, to pick the 12 or the 6, depending on the jury composition. But if you are actually going to be picking them out at the end, I think that gives, you know, equity and balance.
I think it would be a violation of due process for the judge to select, okay, I think the first six people in the box look really good and the other two I don't like the looks of, so I'm not going to allow them.
We just want to make sure all this is on the record. Senator Dingfelder?
Thank you, and thank you for coming here today, Judge. And you answered most of my questions, but one of the questions that I had was how frequently does this occur?
The need to replace juror, not very frequently. You know, frankly, in the 5.5 years that I've been on the bench, I've only had it happen once, where I had an alternate juror or juror replace an alternate after the jury began deliberations. I have had, unfortunately, cases where I did not have alternate jurors, and moments after we got going, a juror has gotten ill, so I now make it a regular practice to have alternates. It has happened, though. I mean, I have can tell you that it has happened around the state. I've had judges from other counties who had very long trials, and that's where it's really more of an issue, when you really had a very long trial, one lasting many weeks, and you've had the alternates sit through the whole thing, and early on in the deliberation, someone gets ill. I know there are judges around the state who address that in different ways. So all I was trying to do, actually, is modify the law to sort of comport with a lot of current practice that's going on around the state.
Thank you, Gail.
Chair Posonski, Senator Dinkfelder, with respect to your question, I can, by reference to federal court, generally if it's going to be a long trial, the court will always impanel two alternates. Mm-hmm. The issue isn't so much having the alternate present during the trial itself. The question is, what do you do once deliberations begin? And this is where the federal system would part company with the bill. The federal system has decided once deliberations begin, they were too concerned about the multiple dynamics that would set in it for a new juror to come into the room. Mm-hmm. And so the federal system opted instead for the court to have discretion either to declare a mistrial or to permit the jury to continue with 11.
And I just would like...
Reasonable minds could differ whether that's good or bad.
Right, and I actually considered that approach at one point, and the problem is there are a number of statutes that talk about a criminal defendant's right to either 12 or 6 jurors, so modifying, making that kind of change required a much more extensive rewrite of a number of bills, so that's why I didn't try to change that approach. I think either approach has its pros and cons.
If I could just follow up, it seems to me under Oregon right now, you would potentially have that ability to, once you designate who's going to be the 12 or 6 going into the room to deliberate, to either call for a mistrial if one of them got sick, or have the parties agree to pursue, knowing that the statute itself may be in conflict with the agreement of the parties. Is that correct, Your Honor?
That's what we've been doing. Some judges have been doing. I've done that myself. I'm just trying to eliminate some uncertainty that may be caused by the conflict. You know, we have a lot of litigation post-conviction, post-appeal that relates to the effectiveness of counsel. It's called post-conviction relief. And what I don't want to have is another reason for someone to say my lawyer was constitutionally inadequate because he or she agreed to this procedure, which was inconsistent with the statute. So that's, I'm just trying to eliminate any argument that that's inconsistent with the statute.
And I appreciate that. I guess the one thing I'd mark on the record, if that would be a decision that would be made by just the attorneys and the judge, or would it would seem like the defendant, he or she, in a criminal case would have to consent to going forward with less than a whole panel?
I think if you were going to go forward with less than the full panel, I would want the defendant on the record to say he or she consented to that, because I think it's problematic constitutionally. The other thing I want to actually point out is I want to respond to the talk about the comment about the enhancement factors, if I may, and that is, I'm not sure I agree with the representation that was made that you can't, if a juror becomes ill and is unable to participate in the enhancement stage of the case but was one of the jurors in the guilt stage of the case, the current law prevents you from replacing them. In fact, I think current statutes allow you to replace a juror who participated in the deliberations with an alternate, and you have no obligation whatsoever to determine how that juror voted. I have never asked a juror who comes ill, you know, how are you vote? How'd you vote? I mean, I can't imagine a judge doing that.
Okay. Senator Cruz.
Yeah. I'm assuming, okay, the jury's gone, has begun deliberations, juror gets ill. In this, you replace him or her. I'm assuming that could potentially be challenged depending upon the I mean, if you've gone 3 days in deliberations and this happens, I guess I'm trying to figure out, would this make that decision unchallengeable, or would it still be challengeable?
I think it would still be challengeable. First of all, the parties would have an opportunity to make a record as to whether or not they think they would be prejudiced by the substitution, and the court would have to exercise discretion about whether they agree or not. And then secondly, it would be subject to review by the Court of Appeals. It's probably a discretionary call, so it may well be reviewed for abuse of discretion standard, but the parties would have an opportunity to make a record about why they think it would be abused. I must tell you that many of the judges I've discussed this with are aware. I mean, every judge that I've talked to has talked about the concern, being aware of the dynamics of jury deliberation and feeling, you know, after a certain point they would not allow the replacement and would rather declare a mistrial. You know, I think it would depend on the individual judge and the individual case. 3 days might be a long time in a case that lasted a week. 3 days might not be very long deliberations in a case that lasted 6 weeks. You know, that would be the part of the calculus from the judge.
Okay, Ms. Chair, I'm just trying to understand. This is more clarification and doesn't really impede remedy. So,
okay. Any other questions?
Judge, could you tell us, I know you can't give us an exact figure, but if you do go to a mistrial, you start the trial all over again, I assume, and what are the average costs of doing that, just starting it up, not the days that it would go?
I'm sorry, I don't know what the average cost would be. You know, it would, I can't tell you that. I don't know the average cost of a trial. It does require you to start all over again. It's basically, we declare a mistrial, we start all over, we impanel a new jury and start from scratch.
You figure it have to be rescheduled, so it has to go on the docket, so then you have the processing just administratively of getting it back to the point of where it's going to be set. I would assume in a lot of these cases they'd probably be quick set, which would mean you'd have to change, potentially bump other trials to get that going because of the, I don't know if the Speedy Trial Act, because of a mistrial, if it kicks in and you have a new time frame, or if you're still under that, but I would assume courts are probably going to want that to be reset pretty quick compared to the normal course.
Generally, the parties want that too. They've gotten all ready for trial. They're prepared. They would like to just do it again as soon as possible as a general proposition, so we do try to do that. I mean, it really would depend on the length of the trial. If we're talking about a two-day trial, the cost is not as great as a 4 or 6 week trial, where you're talking about a lot of money.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I've already asked, but I'll ask once again. Does anyone else want to give testimony on Senate Bill 798? I'm going to close the public hearing on 798. I'm going to open up a public hearing on 799.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the
You can just stay there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 799 changes the circumstances where an attorney can withdraw from a case, declares emergency effective on passage. There's a -1 amendment. It allows withdrawal when written permission from a replacement attorney is filed with the court. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Judge, I need you to put your name on the record once again.
Again, I'm Judge Charles Zanashe. Thank you again for allowing me to address you, and again, thank you to Senator Przanski for sponsoring this bill at my request. I am a circuit judge from Lane County, as I mentioned earlier, and again, I need to make clear on the record that the views I am expressing are my own, and I do not speak for the Oregon Judicial Department. Senate Bill 799 is primarily a housekeeping matter that simply makes it clear that a lawyer may withdraw from a case without permission of the court only when he or she is being replaced by another lawyer. Currently, ORS 9.380 allows lawyers to withdraw from a case under two circumstances, either with the permission of the court or, quote, upon the consent of the attorney. The second option, I believe, is intended to allow counsel withdraw with a new lawyer when a new lawyer is taking over a case. Unfortunately, some lawyers have taken the position that the language of ORS 9.380 sub 1 sub A, as currently written, allows them to withdraw if they wish, thus giving counsel complete discretion to withdraw at any time. Lawyers have never had unbridled ability to withdraw, and such an ability would cause problems for the courts and the parties. Examples of these problems are attorneys withdrawing from representing corporate entities, which can only appear through counsel, or attorneys withdrawing on the eve of trial, This bill simply makes the language of ORS 9.3801A clearer by adding the words written and new, thereby making the operative language of subsection A to be upon written consent of the new attorney. I want to add a couple of comments that weren't included in my written testimony, and I apologize for that. On Saturday, ran into my presiding judge, Karsten Rasmussen, and I was telling him about coming up here to testify. And he wanted me to make clear that he's unaware of any PJ in the state who has interpreted ORS 9.380 sub 1 as it's currently written to allow an attorney just to unilaterally withdraw. He also wanted me to remind you that this statute applies in both criminal and civil cases. And frankly, he foresaw a disaster if we allow lawyers to simply consent to their own withdrawal and be able to withdraw on the eve of trial, especially in criminal cases. It would make it unmanageable for courts to maintain their dockets and would allow a criminal defendant who just maybe doesn't want to face the reality of his or her situation basically to get their lawyer to withdraw without any ability of the court to say, no, you can't. So those are my comments. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right, questions? I don't believe there are any. Let me just see if anyone else wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 799. I will say my understanding, there has been some concern with 799 as it was presented, I guess, in the original form. And so we will be, I guess, soliciting any additional information. This is part of the record, assuming.
Yes,
OLA has, in fact, submitted comment on this legislation dated today. And so that will be up on OLA's or our system. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, I'm looking at that, Mr. Chair, and it's you can only withdraw if there's a replacement. What if something has happened in the relationship that makes it impossible for the attorney to continue?
Can I address that? Sure. Right now, the current statute allows withdrawal under two circumstances. One is with the consent of the lawyer, which we've read to be consent of the new lawyer, or on order of the court. And generally, I think that lawyers file motions to be allowed to withdraw, and they're generally allowed to withdraw if they have a good reason. Frankly, they're pretty much allowed to withdraw for almost any reason if they're more than 30 days out from the trial. If we're getting close to the trial date, then the court may be a little bit more interested in what is the nature of the reason. If there has been, there are circumstances in which courts will grant motions to withdraw even on the eve of trial if the court finds it's appropriate. What we're trying to do here is make it clear that it's the trial court that has the discretion of whether or not to do that, rather than the lawyer who can simply say, here's my notice of withdrawal, see you later. You deal with the issue.
Yeah, and I would just say in most of the cases I see on the criminal side, the defense attorney will be submitting the motion with, and it's required, an affidavit.
Okay.
And they may not be able to go in great detail as to why it is, because it could be...
could be prejudicial if they did.
Exactly.
Yes.
And so you see things, it could be based on financial contract not following through, but for most cases, at least on the criminal side that I've seen, it appears from reading between the lines, the attorney and the client do not meet eye to eye on something to the point of where the attorney feels that they are no longer able to represent the person because of the position the defendant's taking on that matter.
Okay, Ms. Chair, I just want to make sure that the attorney does have the right to go to the bench and say, these are the reasons, and...
Okay. Yeah.
And I do want to talk briefly with someone who shared with me the posting. I think the Oregon Bar Association posted a comment on a bill expressing concern about judicial resources. I can tell you from my presiding judge's standpoint that he's happy to have the judicial resources spent on ruling on motions to withdraw rather than allowing attorneys to unilaterally withdraw. We have to be able to manage our dockets, and allowing people to just withdraw unilaterally would cause too many problems for us, so we're happy to spend the time and energy on that.
All right. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Was there anyone else who wanted to testify on 799? Not seeing one. We'll close the public hearing on 799. We'll open up our last public hearing for the day, Senate Bill 815.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 815 limits liability of agritourism activity if prescribed warning notice is posted, defines agritourism activity, provides exceptions for limited liability if injury is a result of willful or wanton disregard of safety, intentional injury, failure to maintain equipment, and product liability, declares emergency effective on passage. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. I have a number of people who would like to give testimony. What I'm going to do is call the ones that are checked for proponents. Mary Stewart, Scotty Jones, and Ian Tolson. Get started.
I'd be happy to start. Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mary Stewart. I'm an agritourism consultant, and I wanted to tell you a little bit about agritourism. It is growing in Oregon, no pun intended, but it's a wonderful way for farms to diversify and to increase their profitability. And as you think about agritourism, what do you think of? Well, there's about six different kinds of agritourism. There's education, which brings people onto farms to take tours, maybe do some wine tasting, that sort of thing. There's hospitality, where they might stay overnight in a farm stay. They might have a farm dinner. There is fee recreation, such as horseback riding, or maybe hunting or fishing for a fee. There's what we call agritainment. So that's going on to a farm festival, such as right now we've got the Wooden Shoe Tulip Festival going, and perhaps a pumpkin patch. That's agritainment. There's, I guess, what we think of most often perhaps is going on to a farm to directly buy a product, your farm stand, or it might be a U-pick, or choose and cut your Christmas tree. And then the final is what we call off-farm direct sales. And these are things like farmers markets, where people will come and meet with farmers at a certain place in order to buy their products. So as you can see, really agritourism is very broad in its offering. What I've observed is both quantitative and qualitative research, including simple, you know, discussions with farmers, those who have agritourism farms or who would like to have agritourism farms, clearly shows that farmers have found that liability risk and the difficulty in finding affordable liability insurance is definitely a barrier to their business growth. And legislation in other states, such as North Carolina, has been enacted in order to lower that liability barrier. Now, Senate Bill 815 seems to support agritourism farms by improving the limited liability situation, and it certainly has merit in that regard. However, agritourism is very complex. And there are other issues to be considered in developing agritourism. So I guess I would urge the committee to even consider establishing a work group to look at the even broader picture here. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Who'd like to go next?
I'm Scotty Jones. Thank you very much, Chairman and committee. I'm from Benton County. I'm actually a farmer. I have a farm called Leaping Lamb Farm. I'm also the founder of a national organization called Farm Stay US. And so on my farm, I host guests overnight, which is called a farm stay. And that is considered part of that agritourism picture. As a farmer, I am extremely aware of the risks of guests coming onto my farm, and I'm actually a really good example today here. I never fall down on my farm. Walking across the mall, I stepped on one of those marble squares and fell flat on my back. So it's just a good example of not being aware of maybe where you are to start with and things that can happen unintentionally. I do use a liability waiver that I have my guest sign. It's easy for me to do because I take reservations online. But I'm here to also represent those farms that do offer those pumpkin patches or those daily things where they maybe get more people coming onto site. And we are as careful as we can on farms, but there are things that are dangerous. We recognize that with a limited liability sign that we can post at the front of our property, it would make a lot of us a lot more calm even to welcome guests onto our farms. And I do see with my guests, I have them right now, that the benefit that they get from coming on a farm is immeasurable because there are, I think 95% of people live in urban populations now, and people just don't understand where their food comes from. So it's important for us to be able to invite them like that. It's also important for me. I do not make it selling lamb on my farm. My agritourism operation has helped me be viable. And then in terms of representing farmers or from FarmStay US and Oregon Farms, I actually did a survey a couple years ago to see what were their barriers and what were their problems. And one of the very top problems was insurance, liability insurance. So there are those of us who have reasonable insurance, and there are those of us who get our insurance pulled for no reason with no evidence of anything being claimed. So there's a farmer I'd like to represent here. Her name is Cynthia Capel. She's from Albany, and she's had her insurance pulled. She does children's school trips, and she's actually, I think, sent you all a couple emails to the effect of the kinds of ways she's had to pull back from business that helps her run her farm and keeps her sustainable just because her insurance operator has pulled their insurance from her. And so I would just like to say, if you would please consider Senate Bill 815, I think it provides we're not asking that we be not liable for anything. Of course we should be. But we are asking for some limited liability protection. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ian Tallis and I represent Oregon Farm Bureau. We are strongly in support of this bill. There are many farms around Oregon that take advantage of this sort of activity. I know one outside of the Salem area has 3,000 children that come to the farm each year. And many times, this is the first time that child has seen a farm operation, seen how vegetables are grown, seen what happens. And as a working farm, you know, the ground is uneven, there's hoses, there's things that just happen that people need to be aware of. Through no fault of the farmer or anyone else. And this liability is important to protect our farmers. There's only one standard insurance company that that will insure farmers. And so with that, the premiums are fairly high. There's not a whole lot of competition in that marketplace. And I think also this bill really represents a philosophy, and that philosophy is to break down the barriers of urban and rural Oregon and show people where their food comes from. I think that's very important to not only, you know, children, my generation, every generation, to know, you know, where their food comes from, how that process is made. And I think this bill really supports that mindset and that philosophy. So with that, I strongly support you moving this bill onto the floor. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? First, we're going to go with Dean Felder.
Great. Thank you. Awesome. Thank you for coming here to testify. Thank you, Ian. And I absolutely support agritourism, and I was one of the early CSA members in Portland, one of the first CSAs located on Savis Island, and it got me thinking about when we would go out to the farm and actually help with the CSA operations. I started thinking about liability, and I'm sure that probably we weren't thinking about it. The question that I have is about wineries and wine tasting. I spent 4 months working on the wiring bills a couple of sessions ago, and I didn't look, I was reading through the definitions, and I'm curious, and maybe this is something for council to look into, is where wine tasting would fall under, I consider that agritourism. And the reason I bring that up is I'm concerned if somebody is at a wine tasting and they're, you know, having too much to drink and they get in a car accident, then, you know, how would that affect the liability? So I know, I don't know if any of you are attorneys or maybe are
we have someone that might be able to give you more information. Okay. That's going to be coming up.
So that was a question that I didn't see it, or I didn't see it specifically called out in the bill, and that's something I think we need to make sure we have a good answer for.
Can I also say, though, I think that this is on-farm limited liability, and you're maybe talking about somebody going off drinking too much and going off-farm. So unless they crash into all the cars that are in the parking lot.
Yeah, I have an attorney in the room that can actually tell you what they would be doing if this type of thing happened.
Thank you. Our chair is prescient, so he figured that one out.
Senator Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it Ian or Ian?
Ian.
Can you tell me just briefly what other states around us that would be competing with us in this industry, Washington, California, Nevada, do they have a different type of system for insurance, or is it pretty much the same?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Close. I'm sorry, I don't know exactly what the other states are doing in terms of this, but I do know that it is, agritourism is not an Oregon phenomenon. It's something that's happening all over, and with, you know, the wineries up in Washington and their farms, I mean, they're doing the same things. You see this around harvest time a lot, you know, a corn maze or, you know, pumpkins, what have you. So I would assume that it happens heavily around our surrounding states, but I cannot speak to the exact insurance process I have.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I'm going to declare not a potential conflict of interest, an actual one. So, and there are some real issues here that need to be addressed. You know, like my pumpkin rides, when I have my wagon with 40 little kids on it, you know, we do everything we can to make sure we're safe, but, you know, that's... manage, you know, is trying to herd frogs to a large degree with that many little kids, and, you know, and on the other side, you know, like our U-Pick cherry operation, we make sure our trees are at the appropriate height and the ladders are all really good ladders, but you get somebody on the top of an 8-foot ladder, it's a real issue, even if you've given them the right warnings. And the reality of it is that we know we're kind of hanging out there liability-wise to a degree, but there's really no other way to do it. And we decided years ago that I don't want to deprive people of the opportunity to go out and pick their own cherries. You know, I mean, we've got people that come year after year after year. They love it. And so we need to make sure that by giving people the opportunity to experience these things, we aren't jeopardizing the actual operations.
Right. Senator Roblin.
So I guess my question is this trying to parallel what we've done for hunting in private lands, where we have the ability to say you go at your own risk if we allow you on the property, which has allowed us to open up some of the private forest lands for hunting? Or is it a totally separate issue?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Roblin, thanks for the question. You know, we believe so, and I haven't seen the exact language with those activities, so I don't know how closely it parallels, but that's certainly the idea and the concept behind the bill.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Senator Brzezinski, Senator Roblin, I might mention that the equine bill that's in force is similar.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. If y'all step back, I have one other panel. Derek Johnson, Danielle Cowan, and Bill Cross. So, Derek, I think I'm going to ask you to go first, since you're signed up as opposed. The other two are neutral. We'll see how neutral they are once they give us their testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to speak here today. My name is Derek Johnson. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'm a former president of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'm currently the legislative co-chair of that organization. I'm here to express the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association's opposition to SB 815. We oppose this measure on both policy and practical grounds. First, as to policy, and I see Senator Cruz here. I'd like to say hello, and I hope you'll welcome me to your farm stand, even though I'm testifying.
Anytime, anytime.
I would miss the strawberry rhubarb preserves.
We're opening this weekend.
Okay. First, as to policy, we are opposed to measures which reduce citizen consumer access to justice. And that's what Senate Bill 815 does. It seeks to immunize the agritourism industry and the providers from liability should a guest be injured on the agricultural premises. So, in effect, the bill seeks to shrink or maybe even eliminate the citizen consumer's access to justice in the event they are injured at an agritourist facility and by that person's negligence. There was talk about limited liability. I think the phrase really eliminating or limiting altogether liability. That seems to be what the intent of this bill is. The bill removes the duty of the landowner to protect their guests from harm. That's a duty that's been in the common law and the law of the state of Oregon since the state was founded. We oppose limiting consumers' access to justice, especially when there's no benefit in return. Further, we're opposed to giving any business or industry waiver of the duty to be careful. That applies to everyone, and for that policy reason alone, let alone the practical reasons, we ask that you not move this bill out of committee. Now, as to the practical concerns with the bill as drafted, it contains unworkable definitions. It imposes duties on guests that are contrary to the statute. The definition of agritourism, as you will see, is unworkably broad. As written, a citizen that goes to a farm to pick up her CSA basket, as Senator Dingfelder might do, and spends some time poking around or picking a few blueberries, would have no cause of action against the farmer if he ran over her with his tractor. But if he ran over that same person on the highway which fronts his farm, Senator Dingfelder would have a claim. The definition also protects against injuries due to recreation, entertainment, and education, and includes as rural activities the term historic and cultural activities. This breadth of definition within the statute invites challenges and really does little to provide real protection. Further, the definition of inherent risks of agritourism is also unworkably broad. The definition invites challenge because, it talks about protecting against ordinary dangers of structures or equipment ordinarily used in farming. Again, that goes to the example that I use of someone being run over by a tractor, ordinary equipment ordinarily used in farming. Further, the definition of inherent risks of agritourism seems to put a higher duty of care on a guest than on an operator by stating that an inherent risk includes a guest not exercising reasonable caution. Well, exercising reasonable caution is the standard that applies now, both to the operator and to the guest. This statute seeks to eliminate that standard for the operator, but imposes it explicitly on the guest. The bill seeks to keep that standard for the guest and it insulates the operator from that same standard. Another practical concern, the proposed notice, which is in Section 3 of the bill, imposes what's called assumption of risk standard on the guest. The assumption of risk standard has been eliminated from Oregon jurisprudence since about 1975. It's inconsistent with the statute in ORS 31.602 sub 2. Today, we use the comparative fault regime to determine whether or not someone should be compensated for an injury, whether it's on a street, in a farm, in a facility of any kind. So this bill is inconsistent with current law in that it imposes an assumption of risk standard on a guest. Finally, and I think that this the thing that was most revealing to me of the testimony that we heard just a few moments ago was the indication that agritourism is booming in this state, and that's great. I'm enthusiastic about agritourism, but if it is booming, what this legislation is doing is restricting Oregonians' rights with no benefit in return. With agritourism booming, without special protections, without limits on guest access to justice when an operator unreasonably causes an injury, we see no benefit to the Oregon citizens and consumers. In limiting their access to justice by insulating the agritourism industry from the traditional and well-established duty to be careful. So with that, I urge you to not move this out of committee, and I'm happy to take questions.
All right, let's go ahead and get the testimony in. I'm going to start running out of time. Bill, why don't you go next?
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Destination Marketing Organizations, and I would like to apologize to you. I was the individual who asked Senator Thompson to introduce this bill, and it was rather late in the game, and it was based on a North Carolina statute that passed in 2005, and was brought to my attention actually when I was doing a tour of the fermentation sciences program down in Oregon State, and they had just had an agritourism conference down there, and this issue had been discussed, some frustrations with inability to be able to secure insurance, to even get quotes, and or quotes that were extremely expensive for some of the events, just inviting classes to their properties. So because the Oregon Destination Marketing Organizations has many members that are involved in agritourism, we decided to introduce the bill. I think as Mr. Johnson has pointed out, there are some issues that still need to be addressed. We would have liked to have had a chance, obviously, to do more work on it. Just simply didn't have the time, but would appreciate your consideration at looking at this issue moving forward, because it is an issue out there, and it does impact the ability, I think, of many individuals to expand and to grow their businesses. And in many cases, we're talking about farm owners who may no longer be able to sustain their operations based on traditional farming practices. So we do ask for your consideration, and I think as somebody mentioned earlier, it isn't totally unique to Oregon. We do have an equine liability limitation issue here in Oregon that passed, I believe, back in the 80s. And so we're looking at, I think, a path comparable or similar to that. Okay. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Danielle.
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about Senate Bill 815. My name is Danielle Cowan, and I'm the Executive Director of Clackamas County Tourism and Cultural Affairs, better known as Oregon's Mountain Hood Territory. And I also am a member of the Oregon Destination Marketing Organization and on the board for that. Clackamas County has been deeply engaged in the agritourism issue. In fact, we've been on the leading edge of it. Over the past 2 years, we've published our agritourism master plan, which Mary was a little, she was being Coy, but she's the one who actually developed this for our county, and it's been the model that's been now taken out to the state. And you probably heard Bill mention the agritourism summits that were held both in December of 12 and this past March 1st. And that is really what is inspiring, not that, but the fact is that it's growing and people are recognizing that it is a force and it ought to be included as a very worthy tourism activity. Done right, Oregon's agriculture can continue to thrive while small and big farmers can add tourism-related services, events, and products that increase their earning potential. And it could mean the difference between them having a farm or not. This legislation was drafted with the intention of limiting liability exposure for farmers offering agritourism attractions on their land, which can be a barrier, as we know and have heard, to providing those experiences. Certainly, our own study found that this was a problem and a concern for many farmers. And although Clackamas County supports the concept, we don't believe that, as written, this bill necessarily is the best path to take to deal with this issue at this point in time. As drafted, it could have unintended consequences that deserve more discussion and consideration by not only farmers and tourism professionals, but by those who provide public health and safety. That's why, although we support the concept, we feel it needs a little more work before becoming law. Along with the liability issue, though, there are other ideas to consider with it that might, taken together, ultimately achieve better outcomes. One would be to provide some type of liability insurance pool that agritourism providers could purchase at a reasonable cost. That would cover a potential injury. A second suggestion would be to develop some criteria and training for farmers on how to establish and maintain a safe visitor experience on their property. That way, we could help ensure that farmers are set up for success and the public is not being asked to shoulder all of the costs and responsibility if something goes wrong. Currently, we are developing at Clackamas County a customer service for our agricultural partners, and I could foresee us developing another training module that could speak to safe practices on farms. Agritourism is becoming increasingly popular, and it's an important component for our tourism mix. We have Oregon Horse Country, Oregon Wine Country, tulip festivals, berry picking, farmers markets, and so much more. We really support this effort, and we would say that given our interest and investment in this area, we offer our expertise and our commitment to engage further with this body and with any work group that might emerge from this session to further hone our agritourism efforts to ensure that we retain our leading edge. I appreciate your thoughtful time and consideration of our concerns on Senate Bill 815.
All right, thank you. Let me speak from the chair's perspective. I agree that the bill's not ready to go at this point. What I'm going to do is this. The bill itself is not going to move forward in the sense that it won't be posted tonight, which would be required to keep it working. If the parties want to start meeting now, I would assume there's going to be something that may be coming from the House that may have enough of a large enough relating clause that we could do something this session. If not, then I think that we do need to have a work group to continue after session and look at something for 2014. So at this point, I'm going to open it up for any questions if either of my colleagues have questions at this point. Senator Roblin?
I'll just ask the one that Senator Dinkfelder asked earlier.
Yeah, maybe I should have addressed that first. I didn't know that she was leaving, but I'll circle back.
Oh, we'll
with
let her.
Her
know.
Right, thank you. So her question was regarding someone who is served alcohol on premises and then goes out and gets hurt. There's a specific Oregon statute that that says that they do not have, that person that gets hurt does not have a cause of action against the server. And that's 471.565. The statute does allow someone who is injured by a drunk driver to have a claim against the server. If the server serves the driver when the driver is visibly intoxicated, but the drunk person themselves does not have a claim, and that came out of a case, and then the legislature decided that they would change the law to make sure that the drunk person does not have a claim, a premises liability claim or a driving claim or anything else against the server. So that takes care of that. You also asked about the recreational immunity. There is a statute, a recreational use statute, and it is different. It's fundamentally different, and that is that the recreational use statute foresees that these people will be using the property, whether it's warehouse or timberlands or someplace where that's oftentimes where it is in the forest lands where people are hunting. They're not paying to use that property. There's no business relationship between the person that's the recreational user and the landowner. In the agritourism setting, there is a business relationship, and so the law is different in that regard. The business owner is expecting to make a profit on the person that is using their land, and so owes a higher standard of duty to the invited guest. So that's the fundamental difference between them.
Yes, a little follow-up on that then. So the issue about taking students out to a farm where there is no expectation they're going to sell anything, it's only for a visitation type thing, would that be more similar to the recreational one?
It would be more similar, although that's clearly anticipated under S. Bill 815 that there would be immunity for those
kids. Right. Oh, and 815 would definitely be.
Yeah. So, for instance, if the kids are driving around on a tractor and another tractor runs into the back of them, the kids don't have a cause of action. It makes sense to educate farmers if they're going to be bringing guests onto their property, but it doesn't make sense to eliminate people's access to justice if they're injured by a negligent farmer.
All right. Any other questions, comments? Thank you all very much, and so what we'll proceed is at this point, as I said, this bill will not be posted for tonight for the next 8 to 10 day cycle, but if you have a productive work group between now and end of session, we can see if one of the two committees or somewhere else may have a relating clause that could help you out. If not, we'll look at it in 2014.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, we're adjourned until tomorrow morning.